This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Front Row on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng. Like some people, I like to know just about anything, more so when it has to do with what pulses between the ears of artists, their thoughts, their philosophies, their perspectives on life, how they put the pieces together to construct and explain the world they live in and to find meaning and purpose. But when such ideas are articulated not in words, but in the dynamics of sounds, it becomes a challenge. Music can pose such an obstacle. My guest today is David Chin, a music conductor, music educator, and the director of choral activities at Robert Wesleyan College, New York. I thought that's the place for Kodak.
That's true.
This is our first meeting. Where are you from?
Well, I was born and raised in Malaysia. And I went to further my study in the States after I finished with my high school.
And what did you study?
I studied music.
Based on my understanding, not many Malaysians will focus on studying music.
That's right. I had interest in music since I was very young. Actually, there was a piano in my cousin's house, I remember. And every time when my family bring me to my cousin's house, I would always sit right in front of the piano. I think I was 3 or 4 years old. And I was just, you know, play my way through the piano. And I remember...
And it was without lessons.
That was without lesson. And I actually was able to play like some sort of melody, you know. It was some tunes that I heard from the TV and all that. But, you know, I used to hate classical music a lot. I dislike classical music.
What changed then?
Well, it took me a while. I started piano lesson when I was around 9, I think. And actually, I wasn't the one that wanted the piano lesson. My sister was the one that wanted to start a piano lesson. So my dad found a piano instructor for us. And so I said, well, might as well. I'll just tag along. And I think after a year, my sister stopped and then I continued. So that's the beginning of my music education.
You teach at the Robert Wesleyan College in Rochester.
That's right.
What subjects you teach?
I am the director of choral activities there. So obviously I conduct the Robert Wesleyan Chorale. And then I also teach choral conducting. And I also teach two music history courses and introduction music for non-music majors.
In singing though, is chorus singing different from solo singing?
I think in my opinion, there's only one kind of singing, which is called the healthy singing.
Yes. What does that mean?
Well, I think healthy singing simply means, I think in short, it's very difficult to explain singing in such a short time. But in short, I think is to very carefully and to purposefully using our body and making the voice sound and function in the right way.
You know. So in other words, there's no difference between singing classical, singing pop, singing anything. It's still singing with the body as the instrument.
Yes, but I think though, different styles of music require our body to function differently.
By this, you mean the placement of the voice or what?
Oh, not just that. I think besides the placement of the voice, I think how we use our breath and how, you know, we use a diaphragm and all that kind of things also matters. If we were doing Broadway music. So that's very different because I think in Broadway music, we tend to sing more straight tone and without any vibrato when we hold a long note. And then we also sing more with belting. Where in classical music, we will sing more with the full voice.
What's the difference then between the word belting and projecting?
I think both singing the Broadway music and singing classical music requires us to project our voice. I think the difference is just that, I think in short, is the straight tone, singing really straight or singing with vibrato.
Vibrato comes through the classical singing?
Yes. Depends on the rate and the frequency of the vibrato.
The choral group that you conduct, what kinds of songs do they sing? Classical only, or they do the whole range from pop to, you know, ballads to folk songs?
Well, I've been teaching there for almost 2 years now. I'll be starting my third year there when I go back in August. And for us, because it's a classical music department, so we mainly do classical music.
And that goes from madrigals.
True.
And then the music that was written during the classical period and the romantic period.
And the baroque period, yes.
You are holding a performance lecture. What will happen there?
Well, there will be two parts of the concert. The first part, I'll be speaking to the audience and introducing the music a little bit. And then the choir and the orchestra will demonstrate some excerpts, which I will be talking about. And then the second half, we will just perform the music thoroughly.
Why do you need to do this explanation lecture before the performance itself?
Well, I wish I didn't have to. But we need to be educated. We need to be informed. And actually, to be honest, we know that all this information are available to us online today. But I think in a concert context, in our world, in our society, especially in Asia, people have the tendency of saying that, oh, I would not be able to understand classical music. You know, it's boring and it's dull and, you know, there's no reason for me to go to this concert because it has nothing to do with us. So hopefully through this lecture, I'll be able to prove them wrong and be able to strike their interest in Baroque music and in Bach.
But in this case, these are not just music in terms of like orchestral pieces where there are no words. In these two pieces that you are performing, there are words and they are in German.
Yes, yes. Well, that's the reason. We will have a subtitle projected throughout the concert, both in Mandarin and in English, and the original German subtitle. We have to sing these pieces in German because the color and the text, the German text, is just unreplaceable.
Are there translations of these songs into other languages?
I believe so. If you Google some of these cantatas, I believe that some of Bach's music have been translated, have been performed in foreign languages. But it just seems weird. It's like singing Chinese folk song in English, you know?
I can imagine that. David Chin, a music educator, conductor, who will be both lecturing and conducting a Bach performance this coming Saturday, August 9th, at the Word Auditorium Luther Center in PJ. Coming up, we'll talk about Johann Sebastian Bach and the two pieces that will be performed at this choral recital. This is Front Row in the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to Front Row on a Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng with music educator and conductor David Chin. He's leading a chorus to sing a Bach motet and a cantata this coming Saturday. What is a motet and what is a cantata, and how are they different?
In Bach's time, actually, the word cantata didn't exist.
So it's a new word then?
It is a newer word that was coined by a musicologist in the 19th century. Back then, I think Bach would just call these pieces They say Stücke, Kirche, so it means pieces for church, for services. Cantatas basically were written for church services, where motets were written mainly for funeral services. So it's not in a church service context per se. In cantatas, you will hear elaborated orchestration. So, and then you will hear soloists, and then you will have chorus. And normally it ends with a congregational chorale. Where in motets, basically you already have a full chorus singing. Normally there's no soloist, and then there is no orchestra, but when there is orchestra, the instruments will only double what the singers are singing. So we call colla parte.
Which means the instruments will play what the singers are singing.
Exactly. That's for motets.
Would it be fair to say then that motets and cantatas are different in the sense of the functions they serve?
Definitely.
So motets are therefore more funeral-like. They kind of sobriety and somberness, which might not necessarily be in a cantata.
That's right, but we know that some cantatas are pretty somber. But what I like about Bach music is that there's always hope. There's always an answer. It's not just sadness and, you know, disappointment. There's always an answer and hope there.
Is that because of Bach himself? Bach was an optimistic person, a very religious person.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think Bach, before he's a musician, he's actually a theologian. I have heard, I don't remember when I heard this, but in his library, he has more theology books than his music books. So he's a very knowledgeable person.
I read through his kind of biography. Struck me that it was, in some ways, a tough life. But I mean, it was also quite a celebratory life, in that he was considered like one of the greatest musicians in Europe, even during his lifetime.
Well, actually, I don't know if that's true, because during his lifetime, he wasn't popular. I mean, if you look at all his repertoire, in Baroque's time, the genre that's most popular, arguably most popular, would be the opera. But you see, Bach didn't write any opera, because all he has been doing all his life is working in church and writing pieces for churches. But of course, if you look at his passions, if you look at his cantatas, they are so dramatic, they're just like opera, you know, with recitative, with the arias, with the choruses and all these forces. Vivaldi, Telemann, Handel, they would be more popular than Bach was. Yeah. And I don't think Bach expected that we will still be doing his music today in the 21st century.
Really? Because I mean, based on the one I was looking at, this, he was so good at the organ, composing for the organ, and so much so that every time an organ was launched,
yes,
he was asked to go test it out or to play.
Yes, so he was known more as an organist than a composer. Yeah.
But he composed a lot of cantatas.
Oh my gosh, yes, too many. Wow. You can't get too much of Bach, but every Sunday he would compose one new fresh cantata. I mean, you can just imagine what his family would be doing, you know, helping him to copy the parts and, you know, and all that. But every single Sunday he would write a new piece for the church service. And all these cantata, we know they are about in between 20 to 30 minutes long.
That stemmed from the fact that he was associated with the church in the roles that he became when he was like the choir master or the music master, a director, right?
The music director, yep. That's his job.
Now, Bach is from the Baroque period. What are we to understand by, you know, the Baroque period?
Well, normally when we talk about Baroque music, you know, for students that go to piano lesson or people who have known a little bit of classical music, they always think Baroque music is very strict and Baroque music is very boring and all that. But actually, if you study Baroque music, not at all. Not at all. I think one very important element in Baroque music is rhetoric, the art of persuasion through music. So rhetoric. And if you listen to Baroque music very closely, I mean, listen to music of Bach or even Handel, they're so dramatic. In 1 minute, you will have this very soft and a very sad mood. And then all of a sudden, you get surprised. There's always surprises in Baroque music.
The term Baroque, if I understand it correctly, mm-hmm. came from a Portuguese word that suggested a misshapen pearl and is often used, therefore, in a derogatory way. But somehow now it has a different feel to it. It talks about a particular period of music. And that music is sometimes described as being very ornate. So
yes.
When we say something is ornate, is it can be ornate and ornamental? Means there are a lot of it's fussy music.
Well, not necessarily, because in Baroque time, another thing about Baroque music is that music were very often being improvised. For example, things that are being played are not on the paper.
Like jazz today.
Exactly. Things that are written on the page back then, musicians will look at it as just a reference. You know, it's not like, oh, I have to play note by note and I have to play this correctly. It's just like a skeleton, basically, what we have on a page, and musicians are expected to improvise. And that's why if we were living in Baroque period, if we went for an opera performance on Friday night, and it would be very different on Saturday. And also, if we talk about Handel, you know, this composer, people went to his opera not so much to see his opera, you know, because Handel, during the intermission, he would always improvise on a harpsichord. Always improvise on a harpsichord. And that's what people went for. People want to see him improvise. So improvisatory music was huge in Baroque period. And that's why it's so fascinating. Now, for Bach, interestingly, he wrote all his ornaments and all the improvisatory elements that he wanted on the page. So it's already very ornate, highly ornate. And normally singers and musicians, they would do less ornamentation and improvisation when they do Bach.
If we've got these two pieces, right, mm-hmm. we're looking at. Walk us through the structure of the first piece, your motet 227. Give us a context. When was this particular piece written?
It was written in 1723, I believe, if my memory is serving me correctly. 1723 in Leipzig. I think it's for one of the women, the St. Nicholas Church. BWV 227, Jesu meine Freude, in English means Jesus my joy. And it has 11 movements. And very interestingly, Bach have taken some portion of Romans,
From the Bible.
Romans, yeah, chapter 8 from the Bible, and then combining with a hymn that was written by this hymnologist at the time. So in this 11 movement, we have one stanza of hymn, and then we will have one Bible verse, and then another stanza of hymn, and then another Bible verse. So that makes up of 11 movements.
How does this movement flow?
For this Jesu meine Freude, actually it flows very quickly. You don't hear much pauses in between. It goes from one movement to another. There's no instrumental introduction and all that. It's just go right into it. And I think you can also look at it as like a pair, you know, one hymn saying the message, and then you will have, and then you have a Bible verse to respond to that.
So you have the hymn and the Bible reading in a sense working as a pair. That's the dynamics between the two.
Exactly. But you see, very interestingly, if you say it would be pair, then there would have been not odd number, but even number. But we have 11 movements here. So what Bach actually have done is, it's a very symmetrical structure. If you realize the first phrase of this motet is Jesu meine Freude, also the last phrase of Jesu meine Freude of the work. And what Bach had done actually is he worked this symmetrical structure that he places the most important, the central theme in the middle. We know that in music, we'll measure music by bar numbers. If you measure bar 1 to bar 209, that marks the end of first half, and then you will have the center piece, which is a double fugue, and then right after the center piece, you have another 208 measures. So it's exactly the same.
Balance. But it's kind of classical thinking, isn't it? Where everything has to be in a kind of format and structure that is very clear.
But you wouldn't know it if you just listening to it. But on the paper, if you look at it, it is that way. What Bach was trying to do is that, you know, in this motet, the main theme is talking about the spirit and the flesh. So it's a very universal kind of message. It's something that we battle daily, whether you are a religious person or you are not. I would love to do this, but my body would not want to. So he uses this symmetrical structure to portray the battling between spirit and flesh.
And how does it end then? Who wins, spirit or flesh?
Well, I think we'll have to find out. So come to the concert and find out.
As you said earlier, in the motet, throughout is sung by this whole group. There are no soloists.
Yes. In our concert, several of the movements were actually sung by soloists. We'll have some trio and quartet. Because first of all, in our mind, when we talk about Bach choral music, we always think that there will be a huge chorus standing on stage with a huge orchestra. And this is a very outdated thinking. Because in Bach's time, some musicologists, they have been debating, saying that Bach's music was written for one singer on a part, which means that soprano, there's only one singer. Alto, there's only one singer. And then one instrument, one first violin, one second violin, and one viola. And we don't know if that's true, but one of the evidence that they used to support this thinking is that when they went back to the church in Leipzig, when they're trying to rediscover all this manuscript, they could only find one copy for each part. So they assumed that, well, there'll be one singer and one player on each part. So in our concert, we will do both. There will be a chorus singing some of the bigger portion and some of the more intimate and some of the more quiet, I would say reflective movements, I have chosen to use just the soloists.
Is the motet sung in four parts or five parts? Because I've heard that some places it's sung in five parts because you have two sopranos, soprano one and soprano two.
Exactly. The entire motet is written for five voices. And then sometimes you have three voices singing and sometimes you have four.
Now let's go to the cantata.
Uh-huh.
That one, it sounds more celebratory of the two.
Uh-huh.
And I understand this was written very shortly after Bach went to
Leipzig.
Leipzig, yes. Yeah. Because he just got a new position.
Mm-hmm. This is one of his, I think, is one of the church pieces that he wrote for one of the Sunday services. And in this cantata, majority of the text was written by Johann Neumeister, which I found, you know, it's a person that Bach always used. Is a German Lutheran theologian and hymnologist. So this is Johann Neumeister. And he wrote texts for many cantatas and have been used by Johann Sebastian Bach. In this cantata, there's also a symmetrical structure. We have six movements here. So let's take away the last movement, which is a congregational chorale. So let's not consider that. So we have five movements. And then you will see there's recitative and there's aria and there's chorus. And normally, in a normal cantata, Bach would start the cantata with a chorus.
Okay? But this time he didn't.
This time he didn't. He placed the chorus right in the middle, third movement. And then the first and the fifth movement is the aria. The first aria talks about an open mind. And the fifth aria talks about faith and truth. So it's a very similar message. And then the second and the fourth movement, they're recitative. And one talks about sincerity, and the other one talks about hypocrisy.
Okay, for those of us who are not familiar with the terms like aria and recitative, how are they different? Both have words.
Yes.
So how is a recitative different from an aria?
I think the easiest way for us to understand is that in recitative, normally it doesn't sound like a song. It sounds more like speaking. Yes, it sounds more like speaking. It's like, good morning, how are you today? What are you doing? And then in aria, it's a
more
song.
Melodic.
More melodic and less text, more repetition. So probably if it's a message that's very important and Bach thought is worth repeating, he would compose it in the aria. If it's something that, you know, you just need to speak it through and get it through the message, then it will be recitative.
I guess since the cantata is very much a part of the church service, it is also in a way like a sermon, but it's sung.
Yes, exactly. So Bach would compose this cantata according to the church year, the church calendar. So, you know, the church in different seasons, they will celebrate different holidays like Easter or Christmas and then Lent and Trinity and all that. He would compose cantata according to that. And of course, the pastor would prepare his sermon according to the church calendar as well.
In performing these two pieces, you have wrapped them or clothed them in this expression, the reformative spirit from Bach to us.
Uh-huh.
What is this reformative spirit? And
actually, I didn't choose this title. I suggested many titles, and then they chose this one. Well, I think Bach, we all know that Bach is a Lutheran.
And that's why you're performing in a Lutheran hall.
Well, that's one of the reasons. And I think this is very special because, first of all, you have Martin Luther, 1517, October 31st. He was there to lead this reform movement.
The Reformation of the church, yeah.
To lead the church out of corruption. And one of the biggest things that Martin Luther did in music is that he would promote and actually giving back the congregational singing to the congregation. Because before that, all the music in church were done by the choir on stage. Congregation, they don't get to sing a lot. So that's Martin Luther. And then came Bach, also composing all these cantatas and all this motet based on all this Lutheran chorale. And here we are in 21st century. We're trying to bring this back.
Well, you know, I read this, one of his 95 theses that he nailed it in, like you say, 1517. He says, next to God, only music deserves being extolled as the mistress and governess of human feelings. And when music is sharpened and polished by art, then one begins to see with amazement the great and perfect wisdom of God and his wonderful works of harmony. Based on that, I can see Bach was more a theologian than a musician.
Yeah.
I can see how his music is in praise of God.
Yeah. Definitely. Bach himself said that, you know, there's only two purposes for music. One is for the glorification of God, and another one is for the refreshment of soul. And Martin Luther also said another thing. He said that, I'm paraphrasing, okay, not exact word. If you are a preacher, but if you do not know anything about music, then you are not qualified to be a preacher. I mean, isn't that interesting? I mean, I heard from my senior pastor, who was a Lutheran, he's no longer, he passed away. But when I was a kid, I remember he told us that when he went to seminary, he studied theology, but he has to sing in a choir and he has to take music theory courses and all that. But seminary nowadays, they don't teach music anymore. They think it's not important.
So in other words, don't trust somebody who has no music in his life.
We can see from this that how important music was in the church community and in this belief and in this faith.
Yeah. We still haven't come to this reformative spirit. So, yes, he is part of this Lutheran movement with Martin Luther as the first person to kind of, at least we mark the Reformation with his nailing of the thesis and the Gutenberg Church.
Yep.
How else is Bach reformative and to us?
I think that many messages that's being sung, that were being performed on August 9th, whether you are a Christian or you are not a Christian, I think this message still rings in our heart, as I mentioned just now, and that we hope that through these words and to this music that we will be reformed as a person, that we will learned what Bach was learning back then, and we would learn what Martin Luther was learning back then and what they were trying to teach. And I think one of the most important things that we are doing music, we're not just reciting the words, we are actually putting music to the words, is that there's so many messages and there's so many things that cannot be said with words, would not be able to get across with words, but only through music.
So from that perspective, regardless that the songs are sung, the motet and the cantata are sung in German, we should not be worried about our inability to understand the language.
Oh, I don't think at all. But we have done our best, you know, we'll provide the subtitle and all that. But I think if someone when they put themselves in the music, I think they will hear something that's beyond words. Hopefully.
David Chin, conductor and music educator, he will be leading a lecture concert on the reformative spirit from Bach to us. 7:30 p.m. Saturday, August 9th at the Word Auditorium, Luther Center in PJ. It's no accident that the choral singing is there as Bach was a Lutheran. Tickets are priced at 60 ringgit. The choir that will be doing the demonstration and performance is the Ying Chi Choir, the orchestra, chamber orchestra.
Musicians from Malaysia. It's like an ad hoc orchestra that we're putting together.
An ad hoc orchestra calling themselves chamber orchestra.
There'll be about 15 people playing.
And the soloists, sopranos, Chiu Shi Yun and Ting Ming Ni, counter tenor, Chia Wee Kiat, tenor Raymond Lee, and bass baritone Sean Liu. And this is Front Row on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Lim Soon Heng, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.